From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Noe Valley.
We are from Hayward.
We're from the Inner Sunset.
I live in the Inner Sunset.
I live in Sausalito.
Coming up, Yemeni Nobel laureate Tawakkul Karman sends a message to her Bay Area country women.
For a Yemeni woman, without knowing, without knowledge, without learning, she will be nothing.
Then an ancient English dance form jingles onwards in Berkeley.
So if you like traditional folk dancing and you like the bells and hankies and sticks and patterns, it's really a fun time.
And we'll get up close and personal with one of the Bay Area's favorite delicacies.
I guess they taste silly.
It was slimy, kind of like a banana slug.
We're opening shells and opening minds today on Cross Currents. Not long ago, I attended a lecture at UC Berkeley's Bolt Hall, the law school. It was just before sunset, and about 100 Yemeni Americans, mostly young men, filled the room to see and hear their countrywoman, 34-year-old Tawakkul Karman. She's an activist and revolutionary who won the 2011 Nobel Peace Prize for sparking the revolution that ousted Yemeni President Ali Abdullah Saleh. Karman is the first Arab woman, the second Muslim woman, and one of the youngest people ever to receive the Nobel Prize. Yemenis in the room look proud. Gesturing with their arm in the air, Karman chants the famous revolutionary Arabic poem with which she roused Yemeni streets. The room echoes her words. Karman is a journalist with a degree in political science and an honorary doctorate in international law. But she's a rarity in Yemeni society, where only about half of girls go to school, and the female illiteracy rate stands at 67%, the highest in the Arab world. Now, that's in Yemen. You might think things change when Yemenis migrate to countries with high female literacy rates, like the U.S., but they don't. In 2009, only 9 Yemenis graduated from 4-year colleges in California. Most young men become storekeepers. The Yemeni American Grocers Association claims its members own 80% of Oakland's liquor stores. And most young women are outliers if they even go to school.
Some of the families, if they have the power to, you know, have their girls not go to school, even high school, they would do so. But since laws here will not let them do that, that anyone under 18 has to be in a school. Like, it's a must that. So they don't have a power over that.
This is Ahmed Al-Khulaidi, former president of the California chapter of ICIP, the American Association of Yemeni Scientists and Professionals. He and I spoke recently here in the studio.
So you see many girls go into high school. And yes, as you mentioned, that most of them, if not, you know, all, get married in really young ages. The latest will be right after high school. And then like a year later, she has a kid. So she has to choose either taking care of her kid or going to school. So they end up not going to colleges. And that's the major problem there.
Of those 9 college graduates in 2009, just 1 was a woman. I wanted to understand how this dynamic might be changing and what ICIP was doing to help it along, so I headed out to start talking to some Yemenis. Until 2012, the board and staff of ICIP consisted of only men. Men did all the community outreach. Men attended all the events and workshops. Men are the visible members of Yemeni families, which tend to be very conservative. The women lead very private lives, mostly at home. In fact, it was quite a task just to find any of them that would agree to be interviewed for this story, let alone let me talk to their daughters. And bear in mind, I'm an Arabic-speaking, visibly Muslim woman reporter. So if ICIP wanted to reach out to the women, they would need to recruit a woman from within the Yemeni community. That woman is Sumaya Al-Baggal.
My name is Sumaya Al-Baggal, and I am the public coordinator for AAYSP. I was homeschooled for half of junior high and high school. Because I went to Richmond, they weren't really comfortable sending me there.
Al-Baggal grew up in Richmond and still lives there. Her story starts out similar to most Yemenis in the Bay Area. Her father comes to America in the 1970s, eventually brings her mom over in the 80s, buys a liquor store. Al-Baggal was born in 1986. Like most girls in Yemeni families, she was shielded from public school and sent down a different path.
I was really young. I was 18 when I went to Yemen and got married. I think I chose it because it was a natural trajectory of the expectation my family set for me and then also what I understood my position was as a Yemeni woman. You get married and that's kind of where life begins.
For the majority of Yemeni women here, that's also where the story ends, at least in terms of learning. But for Al-Baggal, things were different. After she had her son in 2005, her parents agreed that she could try out community college.
My father was very tenacious and my father was very ambitious, had high aspirations for his children, but he didn't know how to translate that, what that meant in America. He would say things like, you know, I want to focus on the girls. I want to establish the girls because the boys, no one's going to stop them.
So Al-Baggal went on to community college, then UC Berkeley. She's now a second year student at UC Hastings College of the Law. She says she's the first woman in her community to graduate with a degree, a pioneer. Her family's proud, but always well aware of the chatter.
I'm sure that there were buzzes around the community. And I'm sure there was, kind of the sly comments of, what is that like? And what time does she ever get home to take care of her family? And who makes dinner?
Al-Baggal says the challenge is a deeply cultural one. Bay Area Yemenis live in one of the most inclusive, culturally diverse areas in the country, where women's rights and women's education were fought for and championed. Yet they're wary of what many perceive as a morally corrupt society. It's the conundrum of being very conservative in the most liberal of places. And it doesn't help that most Yemenis live in low-income inner-city neighborhoods like East Oakland and San Francisco's Tenderloin District, places where teen pregnancy rates are high, gangs push drugs, and crime is rampant. This is the America they see and live in, so this is the America they fear. This is Bushra Al-Absi. She teaches at the predominantly Yemeni At-Tawheed Mosque in the Tenderloin, which has a full-time school. She says she struggles with parents pulling their daughters out of an even Islamic program as young as 13 and 14 years old. They're either kept at home or sent to Yemen to be raised by their aunts and grandmas. But she never tires of trying to convince them otherwise. Al-Absi says, the parents are too afraid of American society. I have to work with the parents and say, look, you came to America. These girls need to stay in school. To be educated girls means they'll be educated wives and mothers to their children. We need to stress the importance of learning and that it doesn't mean corruption of values. Oakland shopkeeper Abdul Baqi Saleh has a 12-year-old daughter. He eloquently sums up the dad perspective. He says his worst nightmare is that she'll run off with a college boyfriend. Saleh says, I encourage education. I am an educated man and I don't mind my daughter to be educated. But if the right man comes along, marriage is the ideal situation instead of losing her to an American boy or something. The more people I talk with, the more I get the sense that this is something Yemenis can agree on, that a girl should be married first and foremost, then she can get an education if she wants. Sumayya Al-Baggal from ISIP says because of this, the time to get to most Yemeni women is after marriage. When that becomes more normal, then they can start on the conversation about letting unmarried girls go to college. She's starting with celebratory events, like a graduation party ISIP recently held for female high school and junior college grads.
And that was a great experience because the audience was moved by these women in their graduation robes and just how proud they were of their daughters and of these Yemeni women who still looked like Yemeni women, who were great girls, who
were very proud of who they were and who they are and who they're representing, but were achieving these great levels of success. I think for the most part, what I found in the Yemeni community is that for young and old, they would like it to be kind of like a harmony of like, let's move towards change together. Let's all agree that this is good for us.
300 women attended that party, the highest attendance they've had. But Al-Bagal sounds distressed as she talks about how difficult it is to get women to come to smaller meetings and workshops, or even to talk openly about the issue. The community's private, and that privacy stands in the way of these projects. Still, she says their campaign messages must be getting through. She's starting to see more Yemeni women quietly going to school. No fanfare, no hoopla, but change is happening.
I mean, within a few short years, the community was willing to put aside their notions of the big scary world out there and lock up your daughters. Really what it speaks to is those families who are willing to hear the story or hear the example of me or people like me and say, I want my daughter to do that. And she, you know, held on to her roots in a very proud way. And if anything, just enhanced what it's like to be a Yemeni woman in America. Because typically when you see these women, they're just getting educated. They're not changing who they are. They're not adopting another identity. And I think that's giving parents a lot of ease.
When I told Nobel laureate Tawakkul Karman that local Yemeni girls were being discouraged from college, she frowned and looked down for a minute. Then she looked back up and sent a direct message to her countrywomen living in the U.S.
Yemeni woman, you will not be able to change your future, to change your current without learning. You have to be in the school and also in the college. And I am sure that you are so smart, so clever, and you will achieve all your goals.
You can see more of ISIP's work at KALW.org. This story was made possible by the New America Media Women's Immigrant Fellowship. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Anyone passing Christ Church in Berkeley on a Tuesday evening might be intrigued by the sounds coming out of that stylish old building. If you were such a person, and if you ventured inside, you'd encounter a dance lesson. But this isn't the kind of dance you'd see on TV.
Dancing with the Stars.
No, this is the world of Morris dancing.
It's a traditional English folk dance, and it's done usually in groups of 6 to 8 people.
That's Beth Bergen. She lives in Alameda.
And I've been ballroom dancing for about 15 years and Morris dancing for about 8.
KALW's Stephen Short went to visit Beth and the Berkeley Morris dancers to learn more about this ancient dance form and how this group is keeping it alive. I'll let Stephen take it from here.
Morris dancing. Seemingly an innocent pub pastime involving hanky-waving bearded men. Or rather, is it an aggressively contested contact sport?
That's a clip from a comedy film called Morris, A Life with Bells On. Morris dancing is hardly as sinister as this implies, but even the practitioners admit to it being, well, eccentric. Beth Bergen says that's part of the appeal.
Morris is one of the more goofy styles of folk dancing. So if you like traditional folk dancing and you like the bells and hankies and sticks and patterns, it's really a fun time.
Bells and hankies and sticks.
Well, there's two styles of dances. There's handkerchiefs, which are waved up and down and snapped in precision time, usually in time with the music. And there's stick dances, where each dancer will have one or two sticks, and they're clashed in a certain pattern or tossed.
I would say it's certainly eccentric.
Roger Avery of San Ramon is here to introduce some new styles of Morris.
Yes, he's going to do some dances from the village of Headington. Actually, technically, it's called Headington Quarry, and it's just outside Oxford, the city of Oxford.
In the Morris book, or Lionel Bacon's book, he talks about it being brisk,
neat, compact, and I've actually danced with Headington, the quarrymen themselves, and it is very tight.
While this particular dance is new to this particular group, the origins of Morris dancing are lost in the mists of time.
There are records going back to the 1200s. It's in the church records in England, back in 1600s, some earlier.
Shakespeare referred to Morris dancing. Some claim it goes back to the Ice Age. The truth is, nobody knows. The music that goes with it can be sparse, just a flute or a type of accordion called a melodeon. And, according to Pleasant Hill resident Randall Cayford, foreman of Berkeley Morris, it might also include fife and drum, mandolin, fiddle, and or concertina. But what about those costumes?
Well, we call them knickers. That's not what they call them in England. But they're basically pants that have been cut off at just below the knee. And so we have black socks, black knee socks, white knickers, and red vests, and black hats. The hats have ribbons. We also have arm ribbons, and then the bells have ribbons. That's all sort of part of it.
And you have hankies.
And we have hankies. When we're not using sticks, we have hankies.
And there are those bells.
It's a leather pad with a row of bells. These are on fishing hook sort of split rings, just because they bounce better and they last longer. It's a very traditional. Morris teams have bells. That's one of their defining characteristics, is you wear bells on your shins. We also have a hobby animal, which is also very traditional in Morris. In our case, it's a bear, so we have a hobby bear because we're in California.
Not a hobby horse, but a hobby bear.
Exactly. Hobby horses are far more traditional, but we're in California, so we have a bear.
The hobby bear is the team's mascot.
It's part of the performance. It's part of the pageantry. They're the precursors that in American culture have been left over as team mascots.
Lucy, the bear, dances around from time to time, especially at the beginning of the spring dance season, when both bears and Morris dancers awaken from hibernation.
The music is very traditional, and I know that Morris dancing goes way back, but where does this music come from?
I was told that a lot of this was the popular music of the 1800s, that this is music hall popular tunes. So this would be the top 40s.
So they've kept up with the times in that sense.
They keep up with the times. Most of the dances most teams are doing are new. There are a lot of traditional dances, but it's a living tradition that is continually inventing both new dance steps and new dances and new styles.
So there's always more to learn.
Bob Orser practices Morris dance in Berkeley and Santa Cruz. He knows about the old mingling with the new. He came to the ritual known as Morris when he was
51, and I'm 80 now. I turned 80 last January. So, it keeps you in shape. It keeps you from getting old. I recommend it. You know, just anyone who's in their 50s now, borders for 50s, should start doing it, and then they'll live forever, like me.
And with every leap, jingle, and wave of their hankies, these dancers extend the life of this age-old folk custom known as Morris. Capering about in Berkeley, I'm Stephen Short for Cross Currents.
The Berkeley Morris dancers are currently running their annual free workshops. The final two are coming up on September 10th and 17th. Each one features a different style of dance. And you can find a 17th century painting of a Morris team with a hobby horse, along with information on those workshops, all at kalw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Now we'll leave the Morris dance floor and go to a place a bit north of there. It's time for The Answer to Audiograph, our weekly sonic treasure hunt. All week long on KALW, we've been playing you this sound.
We're basically right on the edge of an egret and a blue heron sanctuary.
I guess they taste silly.
It was slimy, kind of like a banana slug.
There's a little muscle that attaches it to the shell.
To find out more about this week's sound, we sent KLW's Leela Day out to the shoreline.
The road that leads here winds past cliffs that drop into the sea, past the cows and horses that graze on the green.
My name's Matt Huffstetter, and we're at Hog Island Oyster Company in Marshall, California. Tamales Bay, the big crack caused by the San Andreas Fault.
The San Andreas Fault runs right down the middle of Tamales Bay. You can't see the fault line. It's underwater, and it's created the perfect habitat to grow oysters for Hog Island Oyster Company. It's just 46 miles north of San Francisco, where the air often feels like a slight drizzle.
So we're basically right on the edge of an egret and a blue heron sanctuary. And you're going to see everything in the water from bat rays to all the different types of birds, fish, occasionally a seal. And then bird-wise, not a better bird-watching place that I've ever been to my whole life.
Right now, though, you can't see any of those sea animals. But they're there. Thousands of living oysters the company's planted. Some ready to be shucked. Others just being stared at.
Tell me what the oysters taste like.
They taste funny.
But did you try one?
No. I'm guessing. I guess they taste silly.
To enjoy this taste, people have reserved tables weeks in advance. They bring bottles of wine, cheese, and salads to accompany their buckets and buckets of oysters. And those oysters are mostly what they talk about.
It looks appallingly nasty.
It's a tough one. You get it sort of open, you got to stick this in and cut that muscle.
It was slimy, kind of like a banana slug going down your throat.
You've eaten a banana slug?
No.
While they eat, the work continues. The company plants about 6 million oysters a year. They start from tiny seeds or spats. These are very young oysters that are ready to be transplanted to an oyster bed. Each one takes 1.5 to 3 years to grow. During that time, they tumble around on the ocean floor, a process that eventually gives them their shape. Then,
once they're taken out of the bay and sorted, they're thrown into these tanks.
That's Walker Livingston. He works here at the farm. He's pointing at giant white tanks full of oysters and frothy salt water.
Chill it down to about between 49 and 52 degrees. Blast it with UV so it kills anything that's else in it. And then finally run it, I think we run it through two different sand filters. And then finally pump it out into here. So it's about as clean as it can get.
Ready?
Hours pass. Shells keep hitting the ground. They're everywhere. The company mostly uses them either for the garden here or to line the nearby roads, creating a chalky, cracked shell sidewalk. Walking feels like you're breaking something that's not meant to be broken. Except everything harvested is meant to be broken, enjoyed, and the experience remembered.
He had a completely full wheelbarrow there a minute ago.
It has that fresh taste of the ocean. That's why I like it.
You know so much about the most random things, Dad.
I know.
From Tamales Bay, I'm Leela Day for Cross Currents.
Well, nobody got it, so we're saving our KALW t-shirt for next week when there'll be another contest. In the meantime, go to KALW.org to hear more from Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. That does it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Isabel Angel, Julie Kane, Audrey Dilling, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Holly J. McDee, Daniel Moore, Mary Reese, and Seth Samuel. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our senior producer. Our executive editor is Ben Trefney. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thank you. We are listener-supported radio. like to dance? Well, if you're listening to the band called Pride and Joy, you may not have any choice, because that's what they do. They make people dance. Pride and Joy is part of the Summer Beat series of free outdoor concerts at the South Shore Center in Alameda. You can hear them this Saturday starting at 7 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.
Mr. Bruce Osborne, this man gonna blow for you. Do this up for these beautiful people out here.
Thanks,
Blow! Okay.